You are listening to Rights Up, a podcast from the Oxford Human Rights Hub. In this episode, we are exploring some of the key themes in Professor Sandra Fredman's monograph, Discrimination Law, the new third edition of which was published by the Oxford University Press in December 2022. Sandra Fredman, FBA KC, is a professor of the laws of the British Commonwealth and the USA at Oxford University and director of the Oxford Human Rights Hub. Today, she is joined in conversation by Rosie Abella, formerly a Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Jaina Kattari, a senior advocate in the Supreme Court of India, and Helen Mountfield KC, a barrister practicing at Matrix Chambers in the UK and principal of Mansfield College, Oxford.
So that brings us right into the debate about affirmative action, as you say, which is dealt with in Chapter 7 of the book, and over the years of the different editions has become more complicated, but also the contours of the debate have become even clearer and more polarized. So as you said, I mean, the background controversy is that if you just look at it on the face of it, we've struggled all these decades to prohibit the use of race or gender to make decisions about distribution. And then we come along with a policy which specifically requires the use of those characteristics in order to allocate benefits. And that doesn't make sense if your aim is to a colorblind world, and if you are living in an abstract context where you don't really see the accumulated and accrued disadvantage from long decades of discrimination. So Justice Roberts, as you said, Rosie, you know, he makes the point, if you want to get rid of racism, you shouldn't use race, and that absolutely ignores the reality of the races central to so many decisions in everyone's lives and disadvantaging or privileging decisions. So more and more the United States has reverted to a much more formal ideal of attempting to ignore race classifications, even though this entrenches inequality, as we saw most recently in the Harvard case, where they struck down long-standing affirmative action programs which had maintained actually Black American participation in universities, in student life. But India, Canada, South Africa all very explicitly say that affirmative action can be a way to achieve equality and is included in constitutional protections. As you said, Jaina, the central thrust of most of the equality policy in India has been around reservation for caste, and as well for gender in some ways and for other groups in some ways. So here we see a very clear divergence. In the UK, there's a provision, but it's almost unused. There's a very narrow provision under EU law for affirmative action. So I wonder whether we could have, we could very quickly get your thoughts, perhaps Jaina, on, you know, coming from a very long experience of the use of reservations, whether you feel now there's actually a need for complementary anti-discrimination legislation, particularly in the light of this new amendment to the Indian Constitution, which says there should be reservations for the economically weaker sections, leaving out scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. So having looked back on decades of experience of reservation, what role do you see it as playing within the kind of tapestry of discrimination law compared to what's surprisingly lacking in India, which is a comprehensive anti-discrimination statute, which I know you've been campaigning for some years now?
In India, the reservation debate is still very, very strong, and reservation is still seen in many contexts, not just caste, as playing a very important role to achieving equality for different groups. So caste and gender has been constitutionally entrenched, and those have been the biggest kind of claims. In the recent times, we also see that disability has played an important role in reservations as well. The new disability legislation that we have provides for reservations in public employment for people with disabilities, And that has actually enabled the visibility and the access for people with disabilities to any kind of livelihood and employment. And that has been really a game changer. And we're seeing that with new groups, for example, the trans community has been fighting for reservations as well. And some states like Karnataka, where I'm based, through some of our litigation, the government has provided 1% reservations for the trans community in public employment. And, you know, you really see that that has had a substantial impact for the community and their status as equal citizens. At the same time, we are seeing challenges with reservations and the new constitutional amendment, you know, bringing about an amendment to Article 15 brings about 10% reservations for people who are from economically weaker sections. So it brings in an economic criteria. And this has been interpreted quite strictly by, in fact, negating other identities. So when this was challenged, when the constitutional amendment was challenged, one of the arguments made was that even if it is upheld, the exclusion from the criteria of economically weaker section cannot mean, in fact, the constitutional amendment says that this reservation to people from an economically weaker section and who are not from scheduled caste or scheduled tribe communities. And so it brought into debate so many different issues of identity, of intersectionality, of what equal opportunity or reservation really is for, because the majority opinion went on to hold that this would not apply to women who are from an economically weaker section. It would not apply to persons from caste groups, minority caste groups who are from economically weaker sections. And the minority judgment, in fact, was at pains to argue that, you know, in Indian society, we would see that those who would really be at the bottom rung of the ladder and who really would be most economically disadvantaged would be other vulnerable groups. And therefore, to exclude them in this reservations would amount to actually not recognizing the fact that they are economically weaker and they do deserve that reservation. And that would not be a right interpretation. And in fact, developed a stronger version of a stronger relevance on non-discrimination, that this would in fact amount to discrimination against those persons. So yes, we see this. The majority in fact upheld the constitutional amendment, and we are now seeing that more vulnerable groups are not getting the advantage of this. And the criteria of economically weaker sections is also quite high. And so then the question is really, who is this reservation for?
Can I just say that I think there is actually affirmative action sometimes in UK law, an affirmative action provision. And you're right that Section 158 of the Equality Act doesn't get used very often. But I remember a case, it was called Kaur and Shah, and it was about an organisation for victims of domestic violence from South Asian backgrounds. And it was a community-run project, but had local authority funding. And the local authority decided that it ought only to give money to domestic violence organisations where anyone could come. And what was being said was, in that case, you are effectively excluding women of South Asian origin because they won't come. And it doesn't matter if you provide translators. They won't come to a domestic violence service that isn't provided by the community. So if you're not even prepared to consider funding somebody, maybe at a lower level because you need to provide things for other people too, but if you're not prepared to fund that service and you exclude it from your criteria for funding, you are effectively excluding those women from that funded service. And the judge in that case said that this is not direct discrimination on grounds of race to fund this service. And he said there is no dichotomy, I'm reading it now, there was no dichotomy between the promotion of equality and cohesion and the provision of specialist services to minority, because that can be anti-discriminatory and further the objectives of equality and cohesion. And we also quoted the Equalities Reviews report, Fairness and Freedom, and said that an equal society recognises people's different needs, situations and goals, and removes the barriers that limit people, what people can do and can be. And that was, I think, a really important decision, because it was a judge recognising why affirmative action is not, as is sometimes presented in popular debate, just doing personal favours to people where, yes, that group might be disadvantaged, but you happen to be the very privileged woman or black person or person from a scheduled caste or whatever it is. And I think it's really important to articulate why affirmative action is actually promotes genuine equality rather than being special pleading for particular groups.
So do you see that that kind of stream might be developed further or continue? Because it is unusual, and it's interesting that Jane has said about quotas for people with disabilities, because that was the old model many years ago, that certain number of employment opportunities were set aside for people with disabilities. And in the end, the disability movement rejected that as being not furthering equality, but cementing stereotypes.
Yes, and I think quotas don't, at least in my jurisdiction, have much public support for that reason. But I think adjusting your structures and saying, well, maybe we'd provide particular services for particular groups if they want them, like there are often women-only swimming sessions in swimming pool, public swimming pools, because often it's women from minority communities. Muslim women won't go to a swimming pool if it's men and women together. So that's a way of making this truly accessible. But if you just said you must have a certain number of places, I think that's different. And I think that's why the concept of reasonable adjustment for disability has been so powerful. And the idea that sometimes you have to treat people differently, you know, that's a way that I think the public's imagination has been grabbed about why you need to adjust things. And then you can get onto, well, you also need to adjust working structures, promotion structures for women. If you say you can only be promoted between 5 and 10 years of starting a practice, for example, you may be excluding people who've had children in that time. Why not talk about experience levels rather than years of practice? So it's about questioning why the structures, the majoritarian structures, are as they are, and using equality law to begin to argue for breaking that down. And I do think that has a social effect.
So that would be the fourth dimension, transformative dimension, without necessarily going down the rest of the route. So Rosie, yeah, go on.
I just want to join in on the affirmative action debate, because it was when Canada brought in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, it was 1982. The Bakke decision had been decided in 1978 by the American Supreme Court, which was the first time they said affirmative action is not okay as a policy. And ironically, they pointed to the Harvard affirmative action scheme and said, now that's an okay affirmative action scheme. Now we all know where that ended up. But as a result of that, the Canadian government put in a particular section, specific section called affirmative action programs in the equality rights section. So the first section is the equality provision, every individual is equal before and under the law, etc. But the second section is, subsection one does not preclude any law, program, or activity that has as its object the amelioration of conditions of disadvantaged individuals or groups, including those that are disadvantaged because of race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, etc., etc. So there you have a constitutional declaration that affirmative measures to assist people with ameliorative program is not a violation of equality. In other words, a rejection of the American approach that all distinctions are by definition discriminatory. They use the terms interchangeably. When we did the Royal Commission in 1983, and I traveled across the country, I had 2-hour meetings with everybody, including business and labor. Every single meeting I had, so 6 in each city, started with a debate with people telling me what they thought affirmative action meant. Nobody knew what it meant. Everybody had a different idea. And I thought, this is crazy. Why are we debating terminology? We got to get at the concept. So I changed the concept and called it employment equity, and said it's about measures that, and again, looking at the American experience, not quotas. Quotas in my lifetime were used to keep people out. Jews were not allowed in universities, in some university. So it was rate of change over time. And employment equity, it has helped women, but it is the concerted effort inside a workplace to make sure that, as Helen said, barriers are eliminated. So that's the strategy. We're now in a DEI world on top of that, where the conversation has really turned counterproductive, in my view. And we've replaced concepts with slogans and jargon that are not always helpful. And we're moving away from what the core objective was, which is to find concepts that assist in reducing the barriers. But I think the most important development with affirmative action or affirmative measures to eliminate barriers is to understand that they are a tool in the human rights kit to assist in making sure that people are allowed to participate. And if the barriers have been so intransigent that it's been hard to do without government assistance, without positive measures, that's not discrimination. It is reversing discrimination. They keep saying this is reverse discrimination. No, it's reversing discrimination. Again, one of those buzzwords that's used to stop a conversation in aid of rights. So I think phrases like color blindness, which are really disingenuous because you can't be colorblind in a world where people are excluded because they are people of color, or religion, not to accommodate religion. So the key is the human rights model of accommodation, reasonable accommodation, so that if the religious or identification has a component that can be accommodated without harm to anybody, and I include in those categories being able to wear a kirpan if you are a Sikh, being able to wear a hijab if you are Muslim, or even a niqab. What is the harm in allowing people to identify publicly with their religion if it doesn't in any way create a problem in society other than discomfort? They are allowed to come in as who they are. And we've come to understand that, but we get tripped up on these American phrases like color blindness. Well, that was really important when Martin Luther King was talking about it in the 60s, because what he meant was don't exclude them because of their color. And now it's being turned into ignore their color and treat them as if they don't have color. Well, that's not going to work. And the same with women, and the same with Indigenous, the same with every one of the groups that's been excluded based on who they are. I mean, we had the Bliss case in Canada under the old Bill of Rights. Pregnancy, a woman wasn't excluded from unemployment insurance benefits because she was a woman. She was excluded because she was pregnant. Women all went, what are you talking about? So those kinds of formalistic approaches to something that is, Sandra, as you have repeatedly said, a context conversation that requires identification of difference, acknowledgement of difference, and then an evaluation as to whether the barrier can come down, should come down, or there's another way to ameliorate the disadvantage. But the key is ameliorating disadvantage. How helpful is it to say affirmative action or whatever? What's wrong with measures that will help people come in who should have been in the first place? So, I mean, I'm finding the discussion now, I'm debating mostly people who are throwing things at me like white privilege. I don't find that helpful, actually. I don't find any of those kinds of stories. I don't even know how to engage when they talk about that. I know it's deeply felt, but we're moving into a whole new world where I think the concepts we're talking about this morning don't seem to be particularly relevant. And I mean, we'll have to see where it goes, because we lived through a whole bunch of human rights movements in this generation. But I just worry that we're stalling for a whole lot of reasons, some of them from our former allies. Am I saying anything that people are nervous about? It's hard to talk about in the States, for sure.
Yes, so I think the last point that we could bring in on this sort of interaction between the law and social currents is just very quickly to think about where the law and particularly courts and lawyers fit, and to what extent we can actually make equality effective by having discrimination laws. So the last chapter in the book looks at how law is shaped by litigation strategies and also how we can move beyond this paradigm of retrospective, individualized, compensation-based, complaints-based mechanisms to a more forward-looking or proactive model of delivering equality law. So I wondered whether we could just briefly talk about what are the promises and the prospects of that. So in the UK, Helen, we've had, as you mentioned, these proactive equality duties, which you've been really very active in litigating about and developing, which is to have due regard in making relevant policy, to have due regard to equality of opportunity, and whether you think those kind of approaches are useful, or is it just such a light touch duty that really all the dust and storm that has been raised around it is not really worth the trouble?
Well, I mean, in terms of proactive duties and the public sector equality duty, I'm an optimist because I think it reframes the debate. So I remember in a case I did about a provision that was introduced in austerity, which prevented you getting housing benefit for bedrooms in a house if it was regarded as under occupation, and it was known as bedroom tax. And some of these cases were about disabled people or victims of domestic violence or various other people who might need this extra room for a different reason, and had that been taken into account in the framing of the law. And I was arguing about the public sector equality duty, and I remember just in argument, this didn't find its way into the judgment, but I was saying that unless in the framing of the policy, the different situation of disabled people had been taken into account, that then the policy might be unlawfully indirectly discriminatory and it should be struck down. And the judge said, but I don't need a public sector equality duty to tell me that a benefits regime has to be devised by thinking about disabled people. I mean, it's obvious. It would be just irrational, as a public law, irrational not to think about that. And I remember thinking, I don't believe that you would have thought that 15 years ago. I think it has reframed what you think, of course, must be taken into account. And that's why this but of course language really matters. Of course, we must secure equal enjoyment. What does that mean? So I do think that using this framing and being confident about borrowing ideas from other jurisdictions, saying how does the human rights idea fit together with the statutory idea, what about imaginative academic ways of framing it like yours, that's all really matters when you're bringing a case. But I've become more cautious about the idea of strategic litigation being a good in itself, partly because I think judges in this jurisdiction are very wary of people who are overtly saying, I am litigating for the good rather than my client. I don't think they like it. I think they think it's doing politics through another means. But also because actually using litigation for a political goal is something that can be done by progressive and non-progressive people. I've seen that with the recent Supreme Court decision on abortion in the United States, for example. The guns lobby in America uses strategic litigation. So I think strategic litigation is something you can do with a political objective in mind. It's one tool in a toolbox. But just to think that it is good and something that progressive people do, I think we have to be careful about, because I think there are really organized movements across the world who are using litigation in ways that probably the people in this discussion would not approve of.
So that's something you might that might resonate with you, Jaina, from India, where public interest litigation, which has also been so central to your practice, and you've really used it very constructively, but you've also seen the Indian Supreme Court being evoked by other people who are not equality seeking groups and who actually have opposite in mind. So would you still have faith in what we might call strategic litigation, which you might call public interest litigation in the Indian context, provided it's properly framed, or would you share the doubts now that Helen has been expressing?
No, I think I'm still quite positive about public interest litigation in India. Yes, we do have instances like Helen shared of conservative groups also using public interest litigation, and that's happened to a fair extent in India as well, especially in a lot of the personal law and gender cases. We see that. But I think largely strategic litigation as public interest litigation in India has been quite positive. And I think one of the factors which make it successful is, as a lawyer and as an activist, I find that when the issue is really rooted in grassroots movements, and it's not just the litigation, but do you have people on the ground, you have a movement on the ground which is willing to take it along and to support it and to provide the evidence in court and to go back to the community with the court decisions. And so therefore, then the litigation is strategic only if it is one of the tools in your bag to bring about social change or social reform. And we see where things have worked, where strategic litigation has worked, and also where it's not. So in a lot of the recent LGBTQI litigation, some of it has worked quite well. So in you know, in 2018, when we challenged Section 377 for decriminalization of same-sex conduct, this was really a 20-year movement that finally went back to the Supreme Court, and the court decriminalized Section 377. And it also, in fact, it led to a whole bunch of directions, not just by the Supreme Court, but by many other high courts, where they recognized how, despite the decriminalization, same-sex couples, trans persons were being harassed by the police. And the court went on to give directions that, you know, the police will not register complaints by family members against same-sex couples or against trans persons who have, you know, who've chosen to be with their partners. It imposed duties on the government to create awareness. And I think a lot of that came from the ground. In a lot of disability rights strategic litigation, courts have come forward and given very, very positive direction. So in Karnataka, for example, the courts asked the government to frame guidelines for public sector examinations, to give reasonable accommodations for candidates with disabilities. And all of these came from the ground, where people with disabilities raise their issues with the court and what their challenges with the, you know, the examination guidelines were. So I think it has worked. And where there is no connect, or where in some cases, perhaps, I mean, I would like to go back to the marriage equality case. This was also a large group of petitions filed in the Supreme Court, which I think at that point, petitioners felt that this would be a right time to take the issue to court. We failed, and court refused to recognize marriage equality and relegated the matter to the parliament. But it made minor gains for the trans community and permitted recognition of marriages of trans persons in certain contexts. And maybe at that point, we introspect and say that was the strategy of going to court the right strategy at this point? Was there a movement built on the ground enough to carry the litigation through for marriage equality? Should we have pushed the campaign on the ground for civil partnership or civil union? So many of these questions do come along, and I think those are the factors which really will decide whether the litigation is going to be successful or not.
So thank you. So from your perspective from the bench, Rosie, you know, seeing these two different perspectives about all these very lots of varying different perspectives around strategic litigation and proactive duties and new forms of making equality laws effective. You know, how do you see it?
My God, I don't know what we would do without lawyers intervening and bringing these issues before us. I mean, it is inconceivable to me that there would be any kind of hesitation. But I understand it, because if you're facing a court or a political climate where you could easily make things worse by bringing the litigation, then I get it. I mean, I understand it, but it really breaks my heart to think that so many people are worried about courts not being responsive. But let me give you a couple of examples of how crucial lawyers' participation was to the development of rights. Just a couple. We have, I don't know what the policies are in England or in India, but we have interveners, and we allow almost everyone now to come in as an intervener. And they have often been one of several, but have been crucial to the ultimate outcome. So starting with Andrews, for instance, our first equality case, it was LEAF, the women's legal organization, that brought before the court the equality definition in the Royal Commission. No, lawyers hadn't followed it, most lawyers. It was a case about whether the citizenship requirement was a violation of Section 15. The first case, LEAF came in and said, you should be thinking about what equality means, and here's a way of thinking of it. Katie McKinnon, I think, was instrumental in writing the brief. Well, that would never have come before the court without strategic intervention. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of, because not the litigation. In the CAP case that you've mentioned, which was an Indigenous rights case where the government, under 15.2, it turns out, brought in a special program for Indigenous fishers to give them 24 hours to do salmon fishing alone, exclusively. And non-Indigenous fishers brought a claim and said it violated equality to have this special program. We had 18 interveners. One of them said, this is protected by Section 15.2, the measure of the equality section that says an ameliorative program is not a violation of equality. One of the 18. It ended up being the way the court went. I could give you many, many examples. So lawyers with experience and an understanding of this unique perspective, because it often is still a unique perspective, are crucial to the developments of rights law. I mean, the NAACP in the United States and getting a victory in Sweat versus Painter in 1950, where schools had to admit Black students in Texas, which of course was overturned by Hopwood when the court changed. I mean, it's really important that courts have the benefit of these arguments. Even if they don't accept them the first time, they're there. We talk to each other. We listen. And it may not work in this case, but if you get the conversation going in our heads, it may very well work in the next one. All of this to say, we as judges can't do it without lawyers presenting us with the arguments and the evidence to tell us why we should go a certain way in areas of controversy, like rights. They're always controversial. And just a closing note on why it's more important to me than equality of opportunity. When I graduated from law school in 1970, that was the era. It was equality of opportunity. And it led to a very vigorous market in tokenism. We had one of these and two of these, and everybody could say we had one. We gave them the opportunity. And I think you have to graduate from opportunity to implementation, because it's a very passive form of rectifying the injustices that come from exclusion based on identity. And so the lingering hold of some of those old phrases, I think, are not helpful. On the other hand, I'm not a lawyer practicing in front of resistant courts. It may be that that's how you get into their head. I don't know.
That's why promoting a diverse judiciary matters so much. And I know that the Canadian judiciary is very diverse, especially compared with the British judiciary. But there's been a changing of the guard in our Supreme Court. There's a very definite soft policy of not allowing interventions. I used to do a lot of interventions for the Equality and Human Rights Commission and various NGOs. They are now quite frequently turned down, almost always. I think they've decided there will be a non-intervention court. And I think that matters much more when you have an undiverse judiciary, because they don't know what they don't know.
Sure.
I'm so worried about the court being an inappropriate forum for political debate. But I think that's what they've done. They can't see the multidimensional nature of adjudication in this field. And I think it's a great shame.
I do too. I agree with you.
I don't know if there are a lot of interventions in Indian courts.
Oh, there are a lot. I was just going to chip in. In India, interventions are actually, we are a very, very pro-interveners court. And I think it's very positive. You do have interveners on both sides of the debate. In the Section 377 case, we had a lot of very conservative religious groups who intervened, and they were allowed to intervene as well. So it goes both ways, but our courts are very, very open to interveners. And I think on many debates and on many crucial cases, they, you know, like you said, Rosie, I think interveners are able to bring in perspectives that the court would not get otherwise. We also have situations where courts take up matters suo moto, on their own. And there they are particularly more open to interveners. And that really enriches the debate, especially on issues of equality and non-discrimination.
Can I just say, I think most of the rights developments in Canada, and we had progressive legislatures, so I don't ignore what they say, but there are areas legislatures can't touch because the controversy is too huge. So abortion rights and gay rights came from courts rather than from legislatures. And if it's not going to come from the independent people who don't have to worry about going back for elections to see whether their decisions are popular or not, in many cases, it's not going to come. So the role of the courts in everybody's jurisdiction is really, really important. And just on diversity, Helen, in the early days, we did have some women, and it became very clear that many of the more progressive feminist judges were not women, they were men. And so because of the wanting to belong and wanting to be like everybody else, we didn't always have women promoting feminism. So it isn't just the appearance of diversity, it's diversity of philosophy, diversity of background. And I know Brenda Kane did some family law, very important to have that on a high court. So it's how you define diversity, but I think you're absolutely right that you do need diversity, and the diversity you're also mentioning, which is the public has to walk into a courtroom and see itself reflected. Otherwise, the legitimacy quotient plummets.
Well, I think we've had an incredibly rich conversation, which we now need to draw to an end. But exactly what I was, you know, what the whole point of discrimination law book in the Clarendon series is, to spark lots more discussion, more debate, more development of all the ideas, which is the real basis of the book and basis of all of our project, and all of us who have been so immersed in forwarding concepts of equality, inclusion, participation, and generally social justice. It's just wonderful to be able to discuss the book with all of you, to get your wonderful views, and also to hear the interaction between you across different jurisdictions. So I hope this is just one of many conversations we can all keep having, and I hope that these conversations continue to build a robust understanding of equality in law and in society. So thank you very much to all of you for giving so generously of your time.
Rights Up is brought to you by the Oxford Human Rights Hub. The executive producer is Megan Campbell. This episode was produced and edited by me, Sophie Smith, and hosted by Professor Sandra Fredman. Music for the series is by Rosemary Ullman. Show notes have also been written by me, Sophie Smith. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you like to listen to your favourite podcasts.